Hello, friend. Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you are new or an avid listener, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us. And we also want to hear from you. Please take our short listener survey. It's located in the episode's show notes. We value your feedback so much, we're going to give away a $100 Visa gift card to one lucky survey respondent at the end of every quarter. Your input will help to inform how we approach conversations in the future. I'm looking forward to hearing back from you. Thanks so much for walking along this journey with us. My name is Keisha Harris, and welcome to the RAISE podcast, where I talk with a client, thought partner, or collaborator about the responsibility, accountability, courage, and engagement needed to lead change that centers on race. Let's face it, these times are making us all take a harder look at ourselves as contributors to professional efforts that address race. These conversations are about change. These conversations are about race. These conversations are about leadership. And these conversations are for you. Join us for brave, transformative conversations, and let us help you discover what it means to take a stand for humanity. I had heard of John Palfrey's parents sometime before we met, as one of my mentors knew them from his medical training in Boston. He spoke of them with great warmth and fond memories. Fast forward about 20 years, then I met John within his first 90 days at MacArthur Foundation. His appointment to lead the foundation came with fanfare and speculation. It is always fascinating to see the changing of the guard at a multi-billion dollar foundation. However, in Chicago, a town that is deeply connected and very racially polarized, what would it mean to bring John from New England into a global leadership role while making his mark locally? So there we were in the fall of 2019. John joined me and his staff in his office, offered warm greetings, and did not miss a beat, getting right to the point of much public debate and some consternation. I recognize that my appointment comes with lots of controversy. My personal background and family history is deeply privileged. I am committed to showing up on race and want to learn from people like you. I felt a breeze of fresh air, hoping that these were the winds of change blowing for racial equity. By all indications, John has lived up to his word to the letter, yet left something out. In his humility, he did not calculate that we would learn from him how large foundations can be bold, consistent, and reliable on racial equity. MacArthur is doing the tough internal work on racial equity while putting its money where its mouth is by reducing barriers to supporting more Black and Brown-led groups. Let's hear more from John about who he is and how that influences how he shows up on race. So, John, welcome to the RAISE podcast.
Keisha, glad to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Not a problem. It's been good getting to know you over the past 3 years of your tenure at MacArthur Foundation, and I've just really enjoyed watching you and your leadership and just thinking about how to leverage all of one's identities and all of one's points of views in ways that are congruent with the organization's mission. So I want to start us out with a question that we tend to ask our guests as we get started. And that is along the lines of identity. What are your identities and how do they impact the ways that you lead on race?
Well, Keisha, let me just echo the thanks back to you. I'm extremely grateful for your partnership at KHA with us at MacArthur as a grantee on some projects and as a contract partner in others. We've had many different engagements and you personally have been very generous with your time in helping me navigate this world of philanthropy. So a personal and institutional thank you to you and KHA before I say anything more. In terms of the identities, I am going through this work as a white male of privilege. And, you know, I think if you've gone through any of the sessions often are used with boards, for instance, where you tick off the different elements of an identity that tend to be favored in our society, I have hit most of those. I do think as you and I have discussed in many different settings, it is a complex factor, particularly as someone who is interested in working on racial equity work, someone who's leading an organization that has devoted ourselves to what we call a just imperative and to be someone who has been and is so privileged, you know, to be in a leadership position can be both both a blessing and a challenge for sure. And that is something I think about every day.
You know, it's interesting, John. I remember when, you know, first meeting you, I oftentimes tell myself like, oh, I don't have a perception of what someone is like. I, you know, just like I'm meeting this person for the first time. And we're all very much informed by the things that we read and the things that we hear. And I've seen all of these different forms of the privilegeometers, if you will, or things that look at our demographics and say, well, you know, if you show up in the world in these spaces with certain visible and invisible identities, that things can be easier or tougher for you. And one of the invisible identities that you have that was made very visible in the selection process of you becoming president of the foundation is your family's legacy. How does that influence the way that you show up?
I've never heard of the privilegeometer, but now I know what to call it. That's good. Yeah, there are many such instruments. Well, you know, it's a complex factor and one that I think for any of us, hopefully our families are both a source of pride and also something we reflect on, regardless of what that story is. And I really strongly believe that we are all shaped by our families and where we come from, you know, in large measure, not hopefully defined by that, hopefully not bound by that, but certainly informed by it. I would say in some ways, the recent history for me is easier than the distant history. So I'm super proud to be the child of pediatricians who have, you know, devoted their work to access to healthcare and racial equity and a variety of other things I'm proud of, and to be sibling of two others who have been working on similar things. And those are positives. The trickier part is being a part of a family that has been in the United States for a long time and has had, you know, both positives and negatives there. So I am descended both from people who have enslaved others and people who have been outstanding and important abolitionists. And I think, you know, for white families that have been here for a long time, that's often true that you're a crossing of those identities. You know, more specifically, my great-great-grandfather is Theodore Roosevelt, who was president of the United States. And that is something I'm super proud of and connected to and think a lot about, and also, you know, aware of his complicated legacy around issues of race, both as the president who, you know, I think was very proud to invite Booker T. Washington into the White House to have dinner, not as a, you know, not in another setting, but really as an honored guest, but also someone who was friends with, say, Rudyard Kipling, who, you know, was famous for a poem called The White Man's Burden. So, you know, a very complicated and intricate set of histories there can go into, you know, specifically, I think a lot about the way in which Theodore Roosevelt was a great leader on conservation and the environment and climate, but he certainly brought a very strong white perspective to that work, not one that honored, as it should have, Indigenous perspectives as an example. So anyway, I bring these aspects of family life to my work every day at MacArthur, and hopefully it informs a positive form of it, but there's no question that it's rattling around up there in my head in complicated ways.
And I really appreciate you for putting the full spectrum of your identity in terms of family and legacy into perspective, because I think it's both a rarefied space that you live in, and it's also a space that I just really want to hear you articulate. Like, what does that mean in terms of your leadership? We've talked at different points in time, and I think that others may have curiosities because I'm like others, I've read about it and, you know, we've talked about it in different ways, but it's like, well, what does John really think about that? Well, how does John kind of live in and through that? Notably, as someone who came in to MacArthur Foundation from having, you know, served on the board of directors for a foundation before, having spent quite a bit of time in the Northeast in very elite institutions, and then showing up as our firebrand, like you were and are unlike anything that I might have experienced or expected. And so when you think about the culmination of those identities, what does racial equity mean to you?
You know, racial identity, I think, is something that we all have and have to think about and work into the aspect of what we do and how we show up everywhere. You know, I think sometimes people grow up white not thinking about having a racial identity, right? Because that is favored or whatever, in a sense. I think there was a period of time when the book, I think of as a Debbie Irving, who wrote Waking Up White, and a number of other texts sort of came out where those of us who grew up in more or less homogenous white communities didn't really think about race all that much, right? Or even think about other aspects of identity in a day-to-day way. I am hopeful that we all think about our identities in ways that are ultimately constructive, that ultimately bring us together and, you know, recognize there are complex aspects of everybody's identity, no matter what, and whether favored or disfavored, or wherever you might fall in that privilege ometer, you know, that there are ways to make it productive. And you know, I think at the end of the day, my view is we need to just all do our best, right, to build a society, to build a multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multigendered, and so forth society that is one that we all want to live in, and where there is equity and inclusion at our core and our core of our society. That's nowhere near where we are today. And I don't think you can get there without grappling with and engaging with issues of identity along the way. But then again, we shouldn't ultimately be defined by it or stopped by that, because as we know, many aspects of it are literally illusions.
Absolutely. And I think we rely very heavily on what our eyes can see and or what external factors are telling us to, like, we should hold this particular identity up, or we should hold this particular identity as a being of lesser value. And so I think it's really fascinating when you put into perspective kind of how identity shapes the way that you see racial equity. And also you're beginning to put into context a bit of the types of things that you've decided to put your name and the institution's identity behind since you've been at MacArthur. How do you account for racial equity in goal setting and mission alignment?
I think that the goal setting is something that we do very, very carefully at MacArthur on an annual basis for sure. And then we check in about it on a periodic basis. The goals are institution-wide. I have a set of goals as president. Each of the people leading parts of our organization have goals, and ideally they all roll up. And at the center of that, we've decided is something we call our Just Imperative. And the Just Imperative is on the MacArthur website. You can read about our version of it. We've updated it over time. It is woven into our values as an organization. And I think it is possible to have goals that don't touch on racial equity, for instance, but it's not really possible, I think, for us to have goals these days that aren't informed by the Just Imperative broadly. So if we're thinking about, I'll give an example, we're working hard to help bring about something like a common grant application for philanthropy or a philanthropy data commons with other foundations and other organizations. It's a complicated and interesting project. If every college in America can have a common app and many high schools can do it that are selective, we should be able to do it or some version of it in philanthropy. Turns out we collect about 40% of the same data every time, no matter what. We at least should have that as something that our grantees don't have to put back in to the system. You know, you might think that's sort of a technology goal, right? Or that might be a collective action problem. I see that as something that relates to equity. Why? Because, you know, if some organizations have a higher barrier to apply to a foundation like ours, and we can bring down that barrier, that will have an equity effect. And is it specifically about race? It's not. But could it affect organizations which have typically not been supported by legacy white-led foundations, and we can improve upon the diversity of our grantees and bring about more racial equity through a philanthropy data commons? Yeah, that has an equity component. So I'm just giving one example that might not obviously seem like an equity-related thing, but I think for every one of our goals, we at least ask the question, if not affirmatively kind of put it back into play.
And I think actually it's so interesting. I immediately think of that as an equity related question or an equity related approach, because the vast majority of philanthropic dollars don't go to Black and Brown led organizations. And so if you're, you know, even if it's cut and paste, the additional time that you're spending to say the same thing to five or six different organizations, if you just said it once and everyone had access to it, that would make things so much easier from a racial equity perspective. It also makes things easier for those of you inside of the foundation, because it's like, hey, I don't have to look at the application, because oftentimes people will share proposals. Both the applicant will share proposals, but also program staff will share proposals among themselves. And it's like, can I just get to the meat of this? What is it that I really need to know? What is it that I need to be able to assess in the context of the work that this organization does relative to our goals? And so it's, you know, I would think it would be something that could help everyone. It's like the curbside effect, right? You know, you've got the cutouts in the curb, and yes, they were intended to help a very specific audience, and targeted universalism, which is another way I think of equity as well. Ultimately, everyone benefits from that cutout. And so what are some other things that you've been up to and that you've been doing that in terms of goal setting? And what are some things also that you, some goals that you've been able to accomplish relative to racial equity that you want to lift up?
Well, Keisha, the curb cut example is a great one. And I think the targeted universalism is a great way to look at it. You know, I think a lot about our taking the disability inclusion pledge at MacArthur, which is something we typically don't sign on to statements and that kind of thing. But I think we were pretty clear that we had not done enough to include disabled persons and disabled community members in our work. And that there's, as you know, a ton of intersectionality with race, unfortunately, within the disability community. I say that unfortunately, just to, in the sense that those who are disabled are more likely to be Black and Brown in our country for a variety of reasons, just being aware of that and actually thinking through our processes. This is a big thing for us in communications. We've made changes to the way that we communicate on videos and so forth, because we've had feedback, including from MacArthur fellows. A MacArthur fellow named Josh Mealy helped us see some ways in which the videos about our fellows, as we were announcing them, were not inclusive. And how could we improve that, in particular for those who have a harder time seeing? And I think there are lots of ways that we can bring about more inclusive practices, especially by being open to criticism and being willing to ask hard questions. So that would be one category. You mentioned this idea around the bring down the barriers on grants, and this idea that people sometimes will use applications they've given to other foundations. And, you know, we had typically not, I don't think ever really accepted a grant application that had been prepared for another foundation, because of course we're special like everybody else is special. But during the post George Floyd period and in the height of COVID, as we were trying to change some of our practices, one of the things we did when we were putting out our equitable recovery grants, which was money we borrowed to give away more money, we accepted grant applications that had been written for another foundation. And I don't think we made any less good grants as a result. I think that was actually a really good thing. You know, we've allowed grantees to make verbal reports as opposed to written reports, because I think I can say this certainly as a former grantee of MacArthur and others, you know, you spend a ton of time on the reports at the end, totally unclear whether they ever get read. I'm sure someone processes them, but I don't think they're really getting thought about and read by program officers, really. You certainly don't get meaningful feedback on it. So why are we making people write long reports if a conversation is just as good? It might, in fact, even better inform the work and have some feedback. So a number of practices that we put in place in the context of the equitable recovery period, we're hoping to figure out how to make those persist. So I think there are projects such as requiring no application for general operating grant awards. We've been doing what we call Gen Op No App for a number of our general operating awards, and I've been approving grants on a general operating basis to organizations with no formal application. So I think there are a number of things that we have been doing and are pushing ahead on. And there are many that are still in the works and not yet ready for claiming any kind of progress, but we'll get there. And on some of them, we probably won't, but we will keep pushing on lots of different angles.
Yeah, you know, and when you talk about these things, my mind automatically goes to trust-based philanthropy, right? Because these are many of those characteristics. So, you know, giving, simplifying and streamlining paperwork and soliciting and acting on feedback and offering support beyond the check. Those are some things that I think you just really elucidated. When you think about some of the other characteristics, like doing the homework and being transparent and responsive and giving multi-year unrestricted funding, what do you see as the opportunity for the field? Not necessarily for MacArthur, but what do you see as the opportunity for the field of foundations that have assets that are similar to your own and that are concerned about, like, are we really meeting the mark? And can our board feel like it's living up to its fiduciary responsibilities?
Keisha, you and I were at the GEO conference a few months ago in Chicago, and a lot of the discussion was around these trust-based philanthropic practices. And I was very heartened by hearing how broadly they were in play. A few months later, I went to the Hispanics and Philanthropy Conference, and I had a conversation on stage there with Pia Infante, who I think is incredibly smart on these issues and she's obviously written a lot and helped shape that idea of trust-based philanthropy and to make it widely known. And they she's written a PDF. There's sort of, I think, a four pager of it that's extremely clear and effective, that's easily Googled, and maybe even put in the show notes for this podcast. So I think there's a lot of really, really good and thoughtful material out there that can help guide all of us. And, you know, I'm a fan of trust-based philanthropy. I think it can mean lots of things to different people, of course. But, you know, in some respects, MacArthur's been doing versions of it for 40 years in the sense of the Fellows Program, where, you know, it's an outside group of selectors and outside nominators and peer reviewers, and the money is given for 5 years unrestricted to people who don't even apply for it. It's a pretty diverse group. So I think there are versions of that that you could call like trust-based philanthropy. There are other places where I think we could use some of these practices to inform and better do our grant making. And we're certainly asking those questions and seeking to do those kinds of training within MacArthur these days, for sure.
Fantastic. And that is an interesting space to the fellows, because a very unique attribute of MacArthur Foundation is the fellowship program. And I thought, well, wow, what if all of MacArthur's philanthropy looked this way? Or what if all or a significant proportion of its dollars went to, you know, in addition to what we do with fellows, 25% of our dollars will go to Black and Brown organizations who will get a phone call one day and find out that they had gotten multi-year support. And so that's something that is invigorating. I don't know that it's in the pipeline or not, but it's something that invigorates me, because I think that we are seeing that move when we look at those types of things happen, when we look at the philanthropy of a living donor like Mackenzie Scott. And I'm just wondering, you know, what are some of your thoughts if you were to be highly aspirational? What would be some of the things that foundations of your sort would be able to do that could be totally off the beaten path, but really effective?
You know, one answer to the question is that there is not one way to do grant making. I think there are lots and lots of ways to do good grant making. And I think it is a matter of what you're trying to accomplish. But I would like to see much, much more focus on doing trust-based philanthropy in many, many areas. And so to your kind of essential point, I would love to see more things like what Mackenzie Scott has done. I think that has broken open lots and lots of possibility ultimately, because people have seen, oh my gosh, you can do this at incredible scale, right? And you can do this with enormous effectiveness and really changing field. And the trajectory of organizations, our affiliate called Lever for Change received such an award. And, you know, I think as Cecilia Conrad, the CEO there, you know, I think it really does provide for Cecilia and her team a different set of abilities to move and act and innovate. I think we can and should see much more of that. You know, whether everything should look like the MacArthur Fellows Program is a different question, because I think that is a very specific mode. But what I would say is really good about that in particular is we're able to shine a spotlight on individuals and fields and kind of activities that typically don't get a focus, right? And eventually, by putting support in hands of people who otherwise are not getting unrestricted support in the same way, we can really help promote not just people, but fields and networks. So I would hope that we are at a point in philanthropy where there is much more innovation. People are trying different things. People are inspired by the fact that more things seem possible. And there, it doesn't necessarily have to be just the same type of program with the same type of relationship between a program officer and a grantee and the same type of project support. I think we can try a lot more. And I think boards can and should be open to supporting the philanthropies and the philanthropic leaders who are willing to take those new projects on and not see them as risks, but see them as, in fact, really exciting opportunities.
I love that framing too, exciting opportunities, because everyone wants to make good on their investments. But ultimately, foundations are not like banks making loans, at least not when it comes to putting out grants. You know, you're not going to get any of the money back. So how do you strike that balance between being really mindful about how the money is invested in terms of these dollars that you don't get back, while at the same time saying, like, what is it that we are going to lose? Because there's oftentimes this question that's out there about reputational risk. And I'm just always curious to know what others think about reputational risk. When you go out and you try something out in philanthropy and it may or may not land the way that you anticipate it, and that's life. But when you think about risk in philanthropy and you think about reputational risk, what are some things that you have learned over the last 3 years that you would wish you had known about before you came into this role?
Well, you know, I think the risk question is one that really requires you to think about your perspective on it. So, you know, my perspective on risk with philanthropy is probably the biggest risk right now is actually not doing some things differently. I look at the world and it seems to me that we're not in many, many respects where we want to be. You could take the racial wealth gap to stick with race. You could take climate change, take the intersection between race and climate. You could take gun violence. You could take nuclear risk, go down the line. How many people are in jail? The racial mix of those who are in jail. These are all things we work on. And in none of them are we in a good place. And so if what we think of as risk is, I don't know, taking some different approaches, trusting in some other people to take the angle, we're never going to move the needle, right? Because what we've done to date hasn't worked. And I think we have to be willing to try some different things, to trust some different leaders, to be more diverse, inclusive, and so forth more broadly in terms of our approach. So to my mind, the bigger risk is, in fact, not innovating, not trying some different things, not being more inclusive, because I think that's going to be effective in my view. So back to the reputational risk question, I know that's kind of the knee jerk. That's the reversion to the mean. I don't think that much about reputational risk, I have to say, within MacArthur, because I think that our staff and those we work with outside the foundation, our advisors, are very, very smart. And I think they're thinking about the kinds of places to put the trust. They are thinking about serious and credible people who are going to do serious and credible work. And look, if some number of those grants go wrong, which of course they will, we'll deal with that. And that's just how it goes. But if we're always trying to have nothing ever go wrong and kind of do everything we've done it the way we've done it in the past, I think we're just going to get what we've gotten in the past and where we are now, which to my mind is not acceptable.
I couldn't agree with you more, because ultimately this is about relationships. And if you are stretching the boundaries and trying to cultivate new relationships and create new space for new people, then we don't have to think about this in a very linear, good, bad type of way. But oftentimes I'm in rooms where I hear people note reputational risk. Well, I don't know if we want to do that, because we could, you know, there's reputational risk. And I'm like, well, what's going to happen? It's not like people are going to stop taking money from you. I mean, certainly there are all types of articles and books that have been written that have been critical of philanthropy. But ultimately, much of what has to be said about philanthropy in the context of reputational risk is not something that people who work in foundations actually hear. And so I really appreciate what you had to say earlier about being open to critical feedback, hearing the tough questions, asking the tough questions, and working to find answers and not being so caught up in the brand so as to not miss a moment to be innovative, because you're not going to get the money back one way or the other. So if you're not going to get the money back, why not lean into the relationship and be supportive of those who are trying to help you track to mission?
Yeah, I think when you say that, Keisha, I'm trying to think about, like, what's the person really saying? Are they really talking about the brand or the foundation? I think there's something to that, and particularly when you've got a family name on it, which is the case with many many foundations, and you want to take seriously how your family is perceived. But I think the other thing that people are worried about is professional reputation, right? If you're perceived as having made bad grants or not, not doing a good job in some respect, that's fair enough. My fear would be, personally, I don't want to be seen as someone who took too few new things on. I don't want to be seen as somebody who was afraid to break some eggs to make the omelet or whatever that is required by uncertain times. And when in society, you're working for a foundation like ours, like, who else has the ability to act the way we do with as few constraints as we do, and in as mission-driven a way as we do? And I will say that's when I get frustrated with colleagues in our field. It's to use the flexibility that we have to make change because we can. And whether that's in impact investing, or it's how we think about investing our endowment, or it's how we make grants, or include people in our work, I think we have the ability to really to do amazing things that you simply don't have, or it's much harder to do, say, in a corporate role or a government role or an education role. So we should take advantage of that.
I agree with you. And I also think, when you say this, I go back to our original conversation around identities. And I think for different people, depending on what your demographic profile is, I think some folks have a lot more room to take those risks than others. In particular, I'm just really stricken by and heartened by the number of Black and Brown folks who are now coming in to lead foundations, and in particular, Black and brown women. And among some that I've spoken with, they don't necessarily feel that they have the bandwidth to do this because there is oftentimes this question that's posed, are you being self-serving? If you're going to work on racial equity and you're a Black or brown person, you're taking risk, looks like you're trying to do something to make your life better. And so this just also brings me to this question for you, John, is like, you've shared institutionally or societally what racial equity means to you. How do you benefit from racial equity?
Oh, well, my goodness, I think we all benefit enormously. And I think the core thing is if we had a more equitable and inclusive, abundant society, I think everybody would benefit. You live in a city like Chicago. Why would anybody want to live in a place as separated and segregated by race and health and, you know, income and so forth as we do? I think the rising tide will lift all boats and would bring about a world and a democracy that we want our kids to grow up in. I want my kids to go to diverse schools, to know people from all over, and for their friends to be healthy and wealthy and all the things that my kids get to be. So I just think we all want this, and we haven't created it yet, at least in the United States, or perhaps in any country in the history of the world in a meaningful way, but we could, and we should try to. We have some of those ideals anyway, written into our constitution, and our laws, and we need to live up to them. But Keisha, I think you raise another good point, which is the one that says, you know, if you're a Black woman leading a philanthropy, which is a great thing, and in Chicago, as you probably know, there are dozens of women of color leading foundations, and many of whom are relatively new in their role. This is not a long time phenomenon, but it's a very important one. And there's great leadership and great things happening. To your point, it should not be asked. I don't think the question should be asked, are you doing this for self-serving reasons? We should all just be doing it because it serves society and it fulfills our missions. But the reality, of course, is that people are going to look at each of us and say, you know, I have been asked, why are you on that stage, right? In a conversation that involves a lot of people of color, I have been told I shouldn't be in this role or whatever. That happens. Likewise, I am certain that you know, comparable questions or inverse questions are asked of women of color in these roles. Why are you, you know, just focused on a particular topic? We will get to a point where those are not questions that are asked. The questions will actually be more serious about the work that we're doing. And I look forward to getting to that point, because while we started with identity, and identity is important not to ignore, it certainly can't be the end of the conversation. And it can't be, you're a white man, so you shouldn't work on race, or you're a Black woman and you shouldn't, you know, direct resources to the Black community in your city. Those are not the kinds of questions that are going to get us where we need to go in our democracy, in our cities, in our communities, in our families.
I agree. I would love to toss out the book much sooner than later. And until we can get people to the point where we're actually accepting people in the full expanse of their humanity, to say that there's as much value for a Black or brown woman leading a foundation of the sort of MacArthur or any other as there is the value that's placed on white masculinity and other identities that come along with it. Like, I'm just looking for that same opportunity, John. Like, can we get down to business? Let's all be in this for the love of humanity. And as we think about the love of humanity, this is, you know, no small responsibility running a foundation and being in this sector. How do you hold yourself accountable in your work?
You know, it is such a strong and important word to be accountable. And I think a ton about it. One thing I think a lot about is accountable to whom? I am challenged often by our colleagues internally at MacArthur, but also externally, you know, are you accountable in this work? You know, I hope so. I hope accountable to a mission we've agreed to a set of values we've agreed to doing the work as seriously and as truthfully as we possibly can. Some of us wake up every morning anxious to do our best. I think I can commit to that I wake up thinking I have an opportunity through this extraordinary role, for however long I'm in it, to do the best I possibly can for our mission, which is to bring about a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. And if I advance that just a little bit today, I will be accountable to that work. What I don't love with the accountability question, honestly, is sometimes I think there's a sense that you have to be accountable to one person or one community or one small set of people. If you don't get this right, you're not actually accountable. I do struggle with that, I will admit. And I think it comes back to what you said previously about, you know, can we be in this in a way that actually is truly inclusive and it is actually about supporting the whole community? So I I don't love the sort of using accountability to as kind of an accusatory way. I like to think about accountability as can we agree to a set of things that we're working toward and then truly be accountable to that. And I think there's a version of it that can really work and meaningfully so. And that's really what I strive to do in my own work.
Yeah. And I think there's also this question too, that's embedded for me as I think about accountability as a community building opportunity. And when I think about community, I think about a sense of belonging. And so I'm with you. I'm like, I'm not really here for the punitive one way thinking or, you know, top down thinking in terms of accountability, but who is it that I show up with and who shows up with me and how do we help each other to see each other better in terms of our expression of our humanity, in terms of expression of our roles and responsibilities, and also in terms of this notion that we can make the world a better place through putting out in a strategic way resources that people don't have to pay back tangibly, but that can be incredible force multipliers in community. And so I certainly appreciate your perspective on that. And it's interesting that you started out answering it in ways that really resonate with me and also spoke to this kind of tendency, though, I think, to kind of hold a threatening space for you didn't do this right on race. And boy, are we going to, you know, X, Y, Z. And that's neither healthy nor helpful. Who and what are some of your sources of support and inspiration?
Well, you know, Keisha, the good news for me is I have lots of them. You are among them and have been a great guide in our time in philanthropy. Kristen Mack, who's been helpful on this particular podcast and many other things, our managing director of communications, MacArthur, is among them. I think about our partners in the work around abundance. Liz Dozier and Sharon Bush have been great guides in Chicago. I think about friends who lead other big foundations. There are a handful that have been, you know, very, very important inspirations to me for a long time. Alberto Ibarguen at Knight, Darren Walker at Ford, and Elizabeth Alexander at Mellon, and Larry Kramer at Hewlett. There are many others who we work with, and Tony Allen and McKnight and on our climate work. So those with whom we partner, you know, on a regular basis in a number of ways, and particularly on these hard questions, who have been helpful in shaping and guiding my thinking. And I could go down a much longer list, but I will spare the rest of your podcast listeners, but there are a lot of people out there who, in the period of time we've been doing this work, you know, for me, the last 3 years, who have guided me. You mentioned earlier family. I certainly think about family members who are very good at keeping me honest and accountable. And so anyway, we listen to a lot of people, I think, appropriately, and by doing that are made smarter and stronger.
Absolutely. And on the topic of being smarter and stronger, as we wrap up our conversation, what do you want our listeners to know, do, or feel as they lead on racial equity and justice?
You know, I've been very struck by the process I've been involved in with some colleagues around which we call abundance. And it particularly has to do with a approach to grant making, in particular relative to the Black community and funding groups for abundance and funding in a different way than we have in the past. Part of the focus with that group is to emphasize joy in the work and to see this as a positive, to see the work as uplifting, both for those we're engaged with and for ourselves. And so, you know, I think finding in the work that we're talking about today, the work that begins with racial identity, but, you know, ultimately gets to a more inclusive, equitable, joyful society, that we should see it as, you know, an incredible opportunity and something that allows for us to grow and be happy individually, to build a society that's, you know, better than the one that we are in right now, to bring about a stronger democracy ultimately at a time when democracy itself feels in crisis. All of these things, I think, trace back in many respects to getting right this topic around equity and inclusion. And I think it's possible. It's possible if we embrace the positive that we're calling people in and not out, and we're emphasizing what we all can do, what each of us can do based on our varied identities to bring about a better world. And I'm excited about that. And I hope we can see this as joyful and positive and exciting to engage in.
Absolutely. Better words could not have been said. When we did the first President's Forum session in late 2018, Bob Ross was there and he talked about racial equity as being an experience of discovery and joy. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate the opportunity to really examine and be in discovery and joy with you during your tenure at MacArthur, during this conversation, I've always walked away from conversations with you thinking like, wow, this can be different and that I can live more fully into my humanity because he's living into his and creating more spaciousness for all types of brilliance to show up in the world. So thank you so much for our time together today, John. It's been a real pleasure. And I can't wait till we get to speak next.
Likewise, Keisha, you always do that. You always ask hard and good questions. And I always come away thinking about different things, but in a positive way. And I can just hear Bob Ross's wonderful resonant voice saying those words. So that's a great invocation. Thank you so much for having me on the Race Podcast. And I look forward to our work together for years to come, Keisha.
John has had a way of demystifying big bet philanthropy from his first day on the job. As a leader of an $8 billion plus organization, his practice points can be applied across organizations in government and business, as well as across the nonprofit sector. The first point is get clear on who you are and how it influences the way that others see you and your leadership. This does not mean groveling or shame for those who come from dominant categories like whites, men, cis-hetero people, and those from wealthy backgrounds. For John, it has looked like not shying away from his whiteness, masculinity, and family background while taking on unprecedented actions to fulfill mission and to drive impact. Secondly, be open to criticism. Steve Jobs said it well. If you want to make everyone happy, sell ice cream. Well, guess what? Not everyone will like the flavors that you have to offer. Leaders across sectors are using racial equity and justice and diversity and inclusion or diversity, equity, and inclusion language to express their commitment to change. However, many get squeamish and throw in the towel when pressed about their strategies and progress. Take criticism as an invitation to assess, recalibrate, and redirect when needed. Be willing to ask hard questions, including, why are we doing business this way? If we have learned anything from the pandemic, large organizations across the board are taking too many steps to get things done. Equity means tailoring options so that people can have what they need to be successful. Ask yourself, have we made this as light of a lift as we possibly can? Chances are that your staff will also benefit from less complex processes while still safeguarding your company's resources. There is no one way to get it right. We will not make progress on racial equity and justice with the old handbook. John said it well. The biggest risk is not doing things differently. You cannot keep doing the same things and expect different results. Dig deeper when your explanation for doing something is reputational risk. Trust your team. Give them enough room and grace to do the right things and support them on getting back on track when things do not go as anticipated. I've been revisiting the writings of management guru Jim Collins. He and John are on the same page. Get the right people on the bus. This means people who are self-motivated to do a good job. And the other practice point that John left us with is be willing to extend your cachet to others. You heard John speak of our relationship and lift up the names of other Black and Brown leaders that he is learning from. Acknowledging these relationships may seem like a small thing. However, when you do so, you signal to those deciding whether to board the Race It train work that you see this work as legitimate and that these are resource people who can be of assistance to your efforts. Each conversation that I have with John gives me deeper insight into what's possible and reminds me that racial equity change management work is a set of processes that will be handed up and evolving for many generations to come. Thank you for joining me today.